I think the only thing that saves me from being the world's most boring party guest is that I discuss a lot of stuff involving medicine, and every so often I can tell you about duck penises and stuff.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, Dr. Bethany Brookshire will talk to us about rats in pants for experimental purposes, the dangers of scientific myth-busting, and the new book, Science Blogging, The Essential Guide. I'm Stephanie Zavan, your host for this week. For nearly a decade, former neuroscientist Dr. Bethany Brookshire has been writing about science for online audiences. Best known to science blogging fans as Psycurious, Dr. Brookshire writes about neurotransmitters, the chemicals that make our brains run, evaluating scientific results in context, rats in tiny pants, and duck penises. You can't forget the duck penises. On this week's show, I'm talking to Psycurious about effective strategies for convincing people of scientific truths, the common mistakes we make when we set out to teach people about science, and the new book she co-edited, Science Blogging, The Essential Guide.
Joining us now is Bethany Brookshire. You will hear me refer to her as Psycurious because she has been that for most of the many years of our acquaintance. Welcome to the show, Bethany.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have been blogging about science and doing it well for a really long time. Tell me how you got started.
Oh man, I'm now the oldest, I'm not the oldest. I'm proud to say I'm not the oldest science blogger. The oldest one I know started in 2006. I started a science blog in 2008 when I was in graduate school because I wanted to actually find a way to teach people. I wasn't allowed to teach because graduate students in medical schools don't really get a lot of teaching time. And so I wanted to perfect my teaching, so I started a blog to practice science writing with the goal of getting better at teaching. And I discovered I liked writing more than teaching or even doing science, for that matter.
Now, what was your specialty?
My PhD is in physiology and pharmacology from Wake Forest.
And for anybody who has been reading your blog for a long time, we know that you like serotonin. Is that correct?
I do. My degree, my actual PhD, was in drugs of abuse, and I've primarily studied dopamine. So I write a lot about dopamine, too. But in my postdoc at UPenn, I actually moved to studying specifically serotonin and what we call neurogenesis, which is the birth of new neurons in the brain. And I studied that in mice.
And while this isn't about science blogging per se, you recently finished a project on serotonin, an unusual science communication project. Is that correct?
Yes, it was wonderful. I worked with Amy Davis Roth for her Patreon, and she had me basically like give her intro to serotonin 101 so she could make art based on serotonin. And it was really cool. I have to say, her painting of a synapse, which is the space between two neurons, she did the neurotransmission of serotonin traveling from one neuron to the other. And it's beautiful. It's really stunning. She actually like really absorbed the structure of the receptors and stuff. It was super awesome and nerdy and gorgeous.
And that's how everybody has reacted to everything that you have had to say about science, right? You just walked into this knowing how to completely explain everything to everybody.
No! No! I was and still am that person who will bore you to death at parties, which is why I'm not invited to parties.
Aww.
But, no, I'm invited to some parties, like the good nerdy parties.
Okay.
But yeah, I think the only thing that saves me from being the world's most boring party guest is that I discuss a lot of stuff involving medicine, and every so often I can tell you about duck penises and stuff.
In fact, you have done a fair amount of not so much these days, but in the past, a fair amount of blogging about the science of sex.
A little bit, yeah. I did a weekly feature called Friday Weird Science, and that's not running, sadly, anymore, but it was a really wonderful opportunity to delve into some hilarious old literature, a lot of which had to do with sex. Scientists have done some amazing and kind of silly, but also kind of pathetic things in the name of sex research.
Can you give us an example that would be, shall we say, appropriate for radio?
So my personal favorite is this man who sadly has departed this earth. I believe he died in the mid-90s, but he was a scientist in, I think, Egypt, and his biggest project was putting rats in pants for long periods of time. He wanted to know if the fabric of underpants could affect the mating habits and mating efficacy of male rats, and therefore potentially male humans. And so he put rats in pants of various fabrics for a period of time and then watched them mate, as one does.
As one does. And you say this as though, and hearing it, I hear it as though this is a very strange thing, but there is an awful lot of research, particularly on, well, let's just say, what makes men more fertile and more able to have sex. Is that correct? I mean, this is a fair amount of what you've written about in terms of weird science.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's loads of research out there. I think the funny part to me was just the rats in the pants. Because figure one of that paper was an illustration of the pants worn by the rat. And he had several different fabrics, so he analyzed the free hang, as it were, as compared to cotton, wool, and polyester. And polyester significantly impeded the mounting abilities of rats, which he concluded was due to electrostatic inhibition. I personally think this was probably due to the fact that, like, polyester doesn't breathe, and
gets a little warm.
The rats got a little warm. If you wear it for that long, it'll get really warm. But my other thought is that possibly the rats were simply too ashamed because they were wearing polyester pants.
This was not research from the 70s then?
It was not. I believe it was the mid-80s.
All right. Yeah. Poor rats.
But I do wonder if those rats, you know, they encounter the lady rat and they're like, hey, hi. So, you may have noticed my pants. I promise it's for science. And the lady rat's like, I'm just going to go over in this corner and groom myself. Thank you.
Okay, so we could talk about this for an entire show, honestly, about your weird science stuff.
Oh, probably. The things I have seen in
and written about
scientific paper form.
But that actually brings me to what we want to talk about. Obviously, it's easy to get people interested in science when you're talking about sex.
Relatively, yeah. It's one of the easier topics, yeah.
People are at least curious, if not interested. And there are a few other topics that are pretty eye-catching. I mean, when you can put big pictures of space on there, it's easy to get people to pay attention to science.
You actually call that space porn?
Yes. It is that sexy.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. But when you're writing about, for example, neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin, what do you do to get somebody's attention?
Well, I mean, these neurotransmitters, they seem really abstract, but they aren't. I mean, so dopamine, many people have heard of dopamine. It's because they've heard of cocaine. Or heroin, or, you know, anything else that gives you a good time. And so you can relate it to stuff like that. Any problems of addiction, and everybody loves to say they are addicted to something. You know, romance novels, video games, cocaine. If you're addicted to cocaine, you actually probably are addicted to cocaine. The romance novels, But so you can talk about that sort of thing. With serotonin, most people have a connection with serotonin because it's very heavily implicated in mood. So most of the drugs that people know of as antidepressants, those are serotonin drugs. Actually, many of the drugs used for migraine are serotonin drugs. So you can oftentimes get to a lot of the neuroscience topics by talking about treatments, illness, things that people, if they're not personally acquainted with it themselves, they probably know somebody who is. And that will usually drive interest in the topic, I think. I also try to kind of give people a sense of the wonder of it all. Like, it takes, I think it's like less than a thousandth of a second, maybe less than that, for serotonin to come out of one neuron, pass through a space, bind to a receptor on another neuron, and pass on a signal. And this is happening every time you do anything. And it's happening all over your brain every time you do anything. And if you think about that hard enough, like, your brain will bend a little. And I kind of try to convey, I'm just awestruck by that. I am awestruck by everything that our brains do and our bodies do to keep us functioning. And we aren't even aware of any of it. You know, you tell somebody to, like, don't think about blinking, and everybody listening to this is going to be thinking about their blinking for the next, like, 3 minutes. But you can't tell someone, oh, think about your serotonin. And all of a sudden, your serotonin is no longer on autopilot. It doesn't work that way. And I love it. I just find it so awe-inspiring. And so I try to kind of convey that sense of, you have no idea how cool this is. Let me share with you how cool this is to everyone I write to.
I have to say, that is what caught my attention about you as a blogger, because I've been reading you probably since 2009, just so folks have some idea here, back in the science blogs days.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you.
Thank you. As a person with a psychology degree who didn't do much to study the physical underpinnings of it all, it's fascinating.
It's actually very interesting, I think, how, and I think the internet has kind of helped with this. When I was trained, so I was trained in physiology and pharmacology, but my degree is in drug addiction, and I was a neuroscientist. And it was actually, we had no required psychological courses. I took one psychology course in my senior year of undergrad. I didn't really know a lot about psychology. And they're so intimately related. And I think that reading a lot of writing on the internet has done a great deal to connect me with the, you know, analysis of behavior that's so critically important. It's just as important as knowing the physical aspects of what's going on.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and we're speaking with Dr. Bethany Brookshire, otherwise known as Psycurious, about effective science communication.
Let's talk a little bit more about the hows of science communication, because we have a lot of people really working to communicate science. And let's just say some of them are doing it better than others.
There are a lot of great communicators out there.
There are.
I have to say.
And there are people who are working very hard to communicate science and don't seem to be doing it quite as well.
We all have to start somewhere.
We do, right.
I was not brilliant when I started. No one comes out of Zeus's head full form to communicate science to the masses. Not even Neil deGrasse Tyson.
You did come out pretty funny, though.
Oh, thank
that
you.
Helps. Recently, you and some other folks, but you in particular, have been doing a bunch of work to help other people understand how to effectively communicate science. There's a book that you wrote, edited with a couple of collaborators on science blogging that we'll get to a little bit later. But you've also been doing a good bit of writing about this, and you have recently done a presentation for the AAAS. You want to tell people what that is?
Yes, the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
So this is the group of people who are specifically interested in getting science out there.
Yeah, it was... I will say that I'm just beginning to delve into this topic. I think it comes as a surprise to many scientists and sometimes to a lot of young science communicators that there's actually a science of science communication. As in, there are scholarly journals dedicated to this. There are people who dedicate their research lives to the study of how to better communicate SciComm, and their work is great. It's really good. I think a lot of times people don't realize they're there or just kind of think that instinct is enough. And when you have really good instinct, I guess sometimes, but I figure, hey, a little extra education never hurt anybody. So I'm just delving into this. There are a lot of amazing experts out there. Dominique Brossard is a really good one. She does a lot of research on this.
Obviously, as you're pointing out, you're fairly new to studying this in a formal way and presenting on it in a formal way. But you do have one advantage in terms of presentation in that you have a background that not a lot of scientists and science writers have. Is that correct? I'm thinking specifically in terms of theater.
Oh, yes. My mother... has a master's of Shakespearean lit and a master of Shakespearean direction, and she actually ran a theater company, which means I was in it. And so I've actually been acting since I was about 6, I think. Obviously, I haven't done that recently, but it does help your public speaking abilities. So yeah, there's that.
Well, and I think part of the reason that particularly a lot of scientists are not gung-ho about getting into science communication in a structured way, more than, you know, teaching the classes that they teach if they're at a university, is that a lot of them are not necessarily gung-ho or practiced in public speaking.
I think that's true. I do think that as you go on in science, I mean, as a graduate student and a postdoc, I was giving scientific presentations to small and large groups about my data once a month at least. And in lab meeting, it was like once a week. I mean, it's not the same as a large audience, but I also think that scientific presentations, they're very structured. You can rely on jargon. You can rely heavily on things that other people say. You know, like, as you would know if you read Parsons 2003. You know, you can start every sentence that way.
That doesn't play for a general audience, is what you're saying?
But it is a very comfortable way to speak to a scientific audience, and it's something that they understand. But kind of making that transition from presenting your cool, fascinating, awesome science to other scientists and having them think, oh, this is cool and fascinating, and then trying to present it to non-scientists and have them kind of look at you like, what? What are you saying? I don't understand. You know, it can be hard.
So how do people who want to communicate science, and let's start from the assumption that we're talking about people with a solid background in science, because I think we have some folks who are YouTubers and then that kind of thing who think science is really cool but don't have that background, and they probably make slightly different mistakes. And I realize I just started this by saying, okay, people are screwing this up, but...
They make different choices.
Right. What are the kinds of things that people have to learn as they get into presenting to a general audience instead of to their specialized science audience?
Well, I would say the first thing that people think of is jargon. And they say, oh, get rid of your jargon. And scientists go, right, getting rid of the jargon. Okay, so as you may know, in the synapse. And it's really hard, and I get it. You know, once you're in graduate school, synapse isn't jargon anymore. Neuron is not jargon. Gravitational waves, not jargon. They're just things that you know. And you kind of assume that other people know them. And so I think that's the first thing. You just have to throw that out the window. You know, start with the brain is made of cells. These cells are called neurons. Many people don't actually know that. And that's okay. That doesn't mean they're, you know, ill-educated or stupid or anything. They just, they don't have the same words they're working from. You know, I think of it as being like every time I walk into a place to get my car repaired, I'm not a mechanically minded person. And they walk up to me and they start saying all these things to me with words like transmission and replacement and expensive. And I'm like, excuse me, you're using jargon. No, it's not quite that bad, but you know, they're using the words they think I should know. And to me, they're actually using jargon. You know, try and imagine yourself in a place where you admit you know nothing. You know, go from there. But I would say the next thing that people often, it's good to keep in mind, everyone likes a story. They love stories. We all love stories. You know, it's why we gossip with each other. We love to hear stories that have a beginning and a middle and an end. It helps if there's conflict and resolution. But conflict doesn't have to be, oh, scientists are fighting. Conflict can be, oh, man, the scientist faced down a 12-month period where her rig did not work at all.
Because that happens.
I think that's a good thing. Yeah, it's a good thing to keep in mind that you need to tell the audience a story. And the story is not introduction, methods, results, discussion. Though it can be. It's a story that you feel will relate to them. So things that, you know, start with a case study, if it's a disease. Or start with, you know, the sense if you're talking about, you know, why you became an astronomer. I mean, there's loads of amazing origin stories. I think if people want to hear what cool science stories sound like, I highly recommend The Story Collider. It's a great podcast where scientists and science communicators tell stories. And they're not stories that are meant to educate, but they give you an idea of what it sounds like when someone is telling a story. And maybe you'll accidentally learn something.
That's not a bad way to learn something. Just sort of accidentally. I showed up. I learned something.
I accidentally learn things all the time.
So something that you talk about in terms of how science communicators view their audience, in particularly in ways that are not correct. We're still talking mistakes here. You mention the deficit model, and I think this is one of the biggest disconnects that we have between people trying to communicate science, particularly people trying to communicate science for specific reasons with specific goals in mind, and the people they're actually trying to communicate to. You want to tell us a little bit about what the deficit model is?
Yes, so it's a very famous model. It's the deficit model of science communication. If only you knew what I knew, you would agree with me. So if only you knew that vaccines don't cause autism, you would agree with me. If only you knew that, I don't know, what are the other things that a lot of people don't know? You know, if only you knew X, you would agree with me.
If only you knew that carbon raises the temperature, holds in solar...
Exactly.
Right.
Right, that sort of thing. I think, yeah, and a lot of people, I mean, it's hard to get away from that because the deficit model of science education is how every single science class is taught. Every single one. You know, you don't know about evolutionary phyla, so I'm going to talk to you about them. You don't know how trees work, so I'm going to tell you about them. And the deficit model of science education has been shown to have some problems with efficacy because a lot of times the deficit model does not, I'm going to go ahead and say the deficit model is not wrong. It's just incomplete because the idea that if only you knew what I knew, you would agree with me assumes that the person listening is just like you. And they never, ever are. Even if they're your identical twin, they are not just like you. When you say something about science, your audience or whoever's listening to you hear it and read it through a lens. They hear it through the lens of their personal experiences. They hear it through the lens of how much they trust you. They hear it through the lens of their confirmation bias, whether they want to believe it or not. And they're going to give what you say to them a different weight based on what they believe and what they've previously experienced. So just attempting to fill a knowledge gap like it's some sort of vacuum is just not always going to work, especially when you have people who may believe things that you're trying to correct.
So you use the vaccines causing autism example. How many people really are there left who have never been told that vaccines don't cause autism? Adults in the adult world.
Probably in the developed world. Okay. In the developed world, probably very, very few. They've been told it. They've been told it a lot. They don't believe the people who are telling them. And there's plenty of reasons why they don't believe that. There's some people who argue, for example, that vaccines have been the victim of their own success, that because people don't see measles or polio or whatever around anymore, they think that we don't need them. There's some people who say that's not true. There are a lot of people, there's actually a couple of really interesting studies going on now that show that if you ask parents why they don't like vaccines, a lot of times it's because they don't like the companies that make them. They don't trust pharmaceutical companies. They don't trust the medical establishment. They're filtering facts through the fact that they do not trust who is giving them those facts and who's giving them the vaccines for their kids. You know, and when you think of it in those ways, you kind of get why the facts probably aren't getting through.
So do we have a better model to replace that with?
Many people still do use the deficit model, but they do it with knowledge of context. The best, the hands down best way to get ideas across is by knowing who you're talking to and by listening to them. You know, ask questions. It's not a lecture, which as a writer, I feel like I spend my entire life lecturing in print anyway. But it's very important to do things like read the comments, you know, read the Twitter things coming back at you and see what they have to say, see where they're coming from. That can make a huge difference in how you present your facts.
So really, we're getting down to the fact that communicating science is a little bit different from doing science, particularly in the social aspects.
It is, yes. It's a two-way street.
Are there other models out there that people are using that maybe we want to, let's call it, problematize the way that we do with the deficit model, that we want to take? And I won't say it's a mistake at this point. I'll say take something that we have perhaps slightly too simple understanding of and broaden it.
Well, I would say that one of the things I see a lot, and I used to do it a lot, and I'm trying not to do it now, myth busting. I'm sure you've seen lots of myth busting. There was actually a recent, really amazing, epic myth busting when a rapper whose name I can't remember at this time, posited that the earth was flat and had like all these various like basic arguments as to why the earth is flat, which it obviously isn't. And Neil deGrasse Tyson actually like walked in on Twitter and was like, here are the reasons the earth is not flat. Myth busted. He ended up going on, I think, The Daily Show and busting myths on the show and dropped the mic. It was pretty sweet, actually. It was kind of awesome.
But did it work?
Well, for the rapper or for science education in general?
Well, let's start with the rapper because obviously we have multiple audiences. So let's take the original first audience. Did it convince the rapper?
Well, that depends. The issue with myth-busting is that myth-busting opens up something called the backfire effect, which is actually believe it or not, a very well-established thing in psychology, the backfire effect, which I, you know, when you hear about the replication crisis in psychology and everything else, you're like, well-established? What? But yes, well-established. Basically, the backfire effect is the idea that the repeating of a myth makes people more likely to believe that it's true.
So we're all in trouble.
Well, it depends on the myth, and it depends on what people believe. So, for example, if you come at the myth and you believe the myth, let's say I really, really want to believe that fairies exist. Okay.
Yep.
And someone says, oh, well, here are all the scientific reasons that fairies do not exist. And fairies don't exist and fairies don't exist. I want to not believe that. And so I am actually going to fall back harder on my own belief that fairies do exist and that all of your reasons are wrong. There's also a part of the problem with myth busting is that we remember myths in a different way than we remember facts. Or rather, we remember them in the same way, and that's the problem.
Okay.
So, say you remember a fact, the Earth is round. Okay? When you remember a myth, what you remember is, the Earth is flat, colon, this is not true. So you remember myths as positive facts with negative tags. Okay? And the problem is that the memory, the longer you stay away from this idea, you know, the longer it just kind of percolates in your brain, the more likely it is that those two halves are going to come uncoupled.
Because the myth is simply simpler.
Yes, the myth is simpler. And so you'll remember the myth, and maybe you'll remember it was probably false, but you can't remember why. And then the next thing you know, you're like, oh, that myth. Yeah, I remember it. It's probably true. So, there's actually a couple of reasons why repeating myths actually causes problems. And it's really unfortunate because myth busting is so satisfying, you know? It feels really good.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and we're speaking with Dr. Bethany Brookshire, otherwise known as Psycurious, about effective science communication.
On the other hand, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson did a great job of busting the myth in the best possible way. You can't really get through to someone who believes really hard. But if you have people who are in that probably mythical population of people who is not really sure whether the Earth is flat or round...
Let's hope they just haven't had to think about it for a very long time.
Right, or maybe there are six. You can look at Neil deGrasse Tyson's tweets, and he actually went through and he offered facts. He said, here are the reasons we know the Earth is round. He did not repeat the myth. Instead, he said, the Earth's curve blocks 150 feet of Manhattan. But since the buildings in town are in Midtown are taller, you won't see the curve. Right? So that's really a good way to replace that myth with a cool fact. The Earth's curve blocks 150 feet of Manhattan? That's kind of neat. You know, it helps replace that with a fact. Or small sections of large curved surfaces will always look flat to little creatures that crawl upon it. Apart from being a pretty sick burn, that also makes a lot of sense. So he's replacing this myth with, hey, here's all the reasons that the Earth is round and it's hard to see, right? Here's all the reasons the Earth is round and we can't see it necessarily directly. So I think in terms of the way he busted the myth, he did it in a really good way because he tried to replace myths with facts without repeating the myth.
Now, you've written recently about the backfire effect and fighting it. This is another area where there is a particularly strong social aspect to communicating effectively, correct?
I would say so, yeah. The biggest thing is that part of the reason that myth-busting feels really satisfying is because it's an opportunity to show how smart you are and how the other person is not smart.
None of us ever want to do that.
You know, I would like to think that.
Okay, maybe we do.
But then I know how incredibly satisfied I feel. I'm like, no, I love to do that, actually. Right. I mean, we love to look smart. And not only do we love to look smart, we love to look smart in front of our friends, especially when we can take somebody down a peg. Like that feels good. I mean, you know, it feels bad, but it feels good.
But the problem with this is that there's always somebody on the other side who is, well, would like to feel the same thing, but isn't necessarily. If you're feeling smart, they're probably not, right?
Yeah. I have yet to see convincing data that shows that anyone changes their minds when you call them stupid. That's all there is to it.
I feel like I almost want to just end the conversation there. But there's actually more in what you were writing that I find really fascinating. You were talking about the kinds of things that you do want people concentrating on when you are trying to, not necessarily bust myths, but replace them with better facts.
Yes. So there's actually, I have to put in a plug for the book here. So you guys should get our book. It's called Science Blogging, The Essential Guide from Yale University Press, edited by myself, Christy Wilcox, and Jason Goldman. And we have a huge, awesome, incredibly talented stable of science writers who contributed chapters on how to be an awesome science blogger. And one of them is Melanie Tannenbaum. She's a psychologist, and she wrote chapter 24, which was called Persuading the Unpersuadable, Denials, Cynics, and Trolls. And so it was about how to persuade people to your point of view and kind of get your ideas across. And Melanie introduced me to something called the Elaboration Likelihood Model by Petty and Cacioppo, which talked about two different methods of persuasion. And it's still pretty well established. The idea is that, first of all, know your audience. You need to know what your audience comes in wanting to know. So are they coming in to your writing or your podcast or your video and they want to learn? They're motivated to learn. They already have some background information on the topic, so they feel really prepared. Those people are much more likely to be persuaded by straight logical arguments, in which case you can say, use the data. And we call that the central route in the elaboration likelihood model. There's also something called the peripheral route. And those people are unmotivated. They're easily distracted. Basically, they're on the internet and they're kind of reading your article or watching your YouTube video while also playing Plants vs. Zombies 2 and Skyping with their mom. And that's pretty much everyone these days, to be honest. Relatively unmotivated, maybe they have like a slight interest in what you're talking about. They're not well educated on the topic. They're easily distracted. Those people are swayed by peripheral cues. Peripheral cues are what we call heuristics. Heuristics are automatic mental shortcuts. And those are the things that we make that make our lives easier. But they can also influence arguments. These include things like appealing to consensus. 93% of climate scientists agree that climate change is caused by human activity. That's an appeal to consensus. And it's used as a heuristic. A famous message source, Bill Nye the Science Guy, believes in human-caused global warming. Other heuristics, believe it or not, people are swayed to your argument by really long articles. Like, the longer it is, the more they think your argument's probably a good one.
As somebody who blogs, I find that both heartening, and I feel like I have an awful lot of work ahead of me.
But, I mean, these are not bad. The people who are using heuristics, who are going through what we call the peripheral model, they're not stupid people. They're just taking mental shortcuts. And maybe they'll come back and read it through later. A lot of times I go through and I skim an article and I get some like heuristic information and then I'll save it to Pocket and I'll go back and look at it later. So it's important to know your audience. And I would say use both of these. Use the data, use the knowledge, use the good logical arguments, but throw in some heuristics. You know, other things, good-looking presenters are very good for heuristics, tragically. But yeah, I mean, throw in a few heuristics, appeals to consensus. You know, hey, even this famous person believes this. That's okay.
And then go into here's why, here's the data. Because some of those people will come back and you'll want to be able to engage them.
And too. Some of your audience will be that motivated group of people that, you know, Googled the topic because they're interested and found your page.
So now that we've been talking about this forever, let's talk a little bit more about the book, because hopefully we've motivated some people to actually want to communicate science online, despite all the potential drawbacks, all the potential failure modes.
And if you need heuristics to motivate you, I promise the book itself is extremely long. And it is recommended by famous people.
Actually, I know there are going to be people who are listening to this and thinking, you're saying heuristic, I'm hearing fallacy.
Oh, no.
We're talking about a difference between proving something and persuading people.
Yes. Yes. Heuristics are just approaches to problem solving. And the ones used in persuasion take advantage of the mental shortcuts that people use. We are not lying to them. I think that's like anathema to my job and anathema to my personality, honestly, but mostly anathema to my job. You don't lie to people, but you can use methods to persuade them that are not necessarily the straight up facts. When you persuade people of something, you know, you might say, oh, these shoes, they're really cute shoes. This famous person wears them. The fact that the famous person wears them is still a fact. It's also a way to persuade someone to buy the shoes. All heuristics right. include stereotyping, which is not good, but it is useful. People rely on stereotypes all the time, and you can say, well, stereotypes, you know, we often think of stereotypes in terms of sexism and racism, and those are bad. But there are also stereotypes where you say, hey, if this mango does not have any yellow in it or red tones in it, it is probably unripe. That is a stereotype that you are making about mangoes, but it does help you pick a right mango.
I like that one. Okay, so we've got the book. We have persuaded some people that they want to do a little bit more to communicate their scientific knowledge. Why do they want to pick up the book, aside from the fact that it's been recommended by famous people and is quite long?
Yes. But not overly long. Not overly long.
Well, and I have looked at who has contributed to this, and they're all people who are well known for making their topics entertaining.
Yes. So
one of the nice things about getting people to write about writing is they can usually
Not a few of them are extraordinarily talented. They all gave us some really great stuff. Well, I would say the thing about this book is when the editors and I were talking about why we ended up working on it, this is the book that we wish we had when we started. Because when I started blogging, I just got a WordPress account and started blogging and relied on some people I knew. And then I just kind of flew along by the seat of my pants, which is awkward because I wear dresses a lot. And I made so many mistakes. I fell flat on my face so many times, you know, and I'm still learning so many things, but there are so many things that I just didn't think to learn, and I got started on late because I just didn't know, and nobody really had anything that could tell you. Everybody had written, you know, blog posts about, oh, science blogging 101 blog posts or something, but they were scattered over every single corner of the internet. This is a wonderful compilation of all the stuff you need to know to kind of get started and give it a try.
What is the topic that's covered in the book that you most wish you had had in front of you when you started?
That's tough. There's a bunch of really good ones in here.
I'll be honest, I'm looking for embarrassing stories. You don't have to give them to me, but
okay,
that's what
I'm looking
for.
One of the topics that I think is really good is Matt Shipman's chapter on metrics. He actually talks about how to figure out if you're reaching the audience you're reaching, who you're reaching. He's got all the tools, and that's super useful. I mean, a lot of us still feel like we're just kind of typing into the void, you know? So his chapter on metrics, actually, when I read the first draft of it, I actually started changing a lot of the stuff I was doing. So nice. He definitely had that. The other ones I really liked, I love Liz Neely's chapter on self-promotion.
But that's the easiest thing to do, isn't it?
No. my soul cringes a little every time I type the phrase, please retweet or please read. I never type those phrases. The only time I did that was when I was trying to help a dude find his plane tickets. But I feel a little part of my soul just shrivels up and dies because girls are not supposed to act like their stuff is awesome. They're supposed to put it out and hope people recognize it on its own merits and will love it because it's really good. You know, you're not supposed to actually promote yourself. This is the internet. The internet is mostly porn, and the bit that's not porn, there's so much out there. You have to get your stuff out, and that means self-promotion. And her chapter was spectacular on that. It will change everything you're doing and will persuade you gently. Really, every chapter in here is well worth reading. I think Emily Willingham's chapter on writing about controversial topics is a very, very useful one, because a lot of us will stumble into difficult topics. I know for me, I frequently have to tread very careful lines when writing about animal research. A lot of people like to write about vaccines. A lot of people like to write about autism. A lot of people, you know, like to write about things that are controversial. And there's a separate set of stuff that you need to think about when you do that. So I really love her chapter. Janet Stemwedel's chapter on ethics in blogging is something I think most of us never, ever think about, and something that we should. You know, there are so many times I've posted rants about, you know, things I've had opinions on, either on my blog or on Facebook or, you know, something like that. And Janet's chapter has significantly decreased my ranting, because she says, you know, think, is it useful? Is it helpful? Or are you just being a jerk? And I think that's a really important thing for a lot of bloggers to keep in mind, because it's fun to be a jerk, you know? It is.
At least sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are lots of really fantastic chapters. I'd recommend them all, really. Chapters 1 through 27, really excellent, excellent reading material.
All right. And before we wrap this up, we should also talk about your most recent gig, because I think this is really pretty important in terms of science communicating. And you're now working with a group of people who I have been pointing to as folks getting it right for several years.
You mean Science for the People?
I do mean, yes, Science for the People.
I am so excited. Science for the People is a very long-running podcast that has been running since, I think, 2009, with a wonderfully talented ragtag band of enthusiastic Canadians who just really want to talk about the science that impacts people's everyday lives and that people think about and have thoughts about and aren't really sure where to turn to for information. They're always really fact-based. They're always very careful. They have great experts on. You know, it's not a curated, you know, Radiolab type production. This is really well done interviews with scientists talking about important topics. And it's just wonderful. I was a guest on it numerous times, and I was really honored when they asked me to be a host. So I'm very delighted. I can honestly say that Science for the People is one of the only podcasts I've ever listened to that changed my mind about something, purely because they covered it so sensitively and with such great expertise, like so many great experts weighing in. They actually changed my mind.
Do you mind telling us which topic that was?
It was actually male circumcision.
All right. So we'll tell people they need to go find that episode, as well as listening to the one that you just put out.
Oh, yes. My first episode is on Zika. Because of course it is.
Of course it is. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and get back out there and keep communicating science and how to communicate science in, there has to be some medium you have not completely conquered yet. So get out there and do that and come back and tell us about it.
You know, video is still awaits.
There we go. Thanks, Bethany.
Thank you so much.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.